he always moved against the mainstream. Back in America, Fang Lijun sent me a letter telling me that he was doing odd jobs in New York's Chinatown. At the time, I was back in Taiwan working for the United Daily, and I heard that the China Times Weekly News had set up an editorial office in New York. I casually recommended Fang Lijun to them, and they actually brought him in to act as an editorial assistant there. In no time at all, they promoted him to assistant editor. Fang Lijun wrote and thanked me profusely, and I really did feel a special sense of accomplishment. I knew that Fang Lijun, as an experienced and knowledgeable jack-of-all-trades, was perfectly suited to being an editor for a news magazine. The next time I received a letter from him, Fang Lijun was in Nigeria. He later told me that he'd always kept in touch with a Nigerian he'd met in the International Guest House in Chungking Mansions, and he'd invited him to Africa. When Fang Lijun was young, he had always dreamt about going to friendly states like Ghana, Zambia and Tanzania and making a contribution to their development. So he went without the slightest hesitation. It turned out that his Nigerian friend wanted to trade with China. He asked him to be his partner. Fang Lijun thought of all those red, white and blue fabric bags the Chinese used to carry goods and other things when travelling. They could buy them in China, ship them to Nigeria, and sell them all over West and Central Africa. Those red, white and blue cloth bags were a big hit with the Africans, and so Fang Lijun's partner wanted them to set up their own factory and make the bags themselves in Lagos. After making money in the Nigerian China trade, Fang Lijun visited Ghana, Zambia and Tanzania, but he didn't want to end his days in Africa. He went back to live in China with a plan to set up a small Cantonese restaurant just outside Lijiang City in Yunnan. Luckily for him, he was too slow. The restaurant plan came to nothing long before Lijiang was devastated by the great earthquake of 3rd of February 1996. Fang Lijun was indifferent to this failure. He travelled all over Western China. He said he wanted to enjoy various places before they were developed for the tourist trade. I remember he predicted that when China started to develop its tourist trade, too many people would come and ruin China's scenic and historic spots. He travelled for 7 or 8 years, visiting Xinjiang, Tibet, Inner Mongolia, Qinghai, Yunnan, Guizhou, Hunan, and Sichuan. He went on foot, by train, by long-distance bus, hitching rides on passing trucks. He even had a ride on a military transport plane. If you show him any piece of cloth embroidered by any of the minority peoples, Fang Lijun can tell you right off if it was produced by the Tong of Guangxi, the Yao or the Miao, or Hmong from the southwest, and probably exactly where they made it. Whenever his money ran low, he would sign on as a cook in tourist areas. Because the tourists never came back, he told me, it was just like fooling the foreigners in American Chinatowns with half-Chinese, half-foreign Chinese cuisine. In 2006, he moved to Beijing, said he wanted to see what it would be like to be an Olympic volunteer. When we met again, I learned that he'd changed his name many years before from Fang Lijun to Fang Chaodi. According to him, one day he was walking past the Temple of the Sun in Beijing, when he saw many parents picking up their children from the Fang Chaodi, or Fragrant Grass, elementary school. And so he decided to change his name to Fang Chaodi. That's just old Fang's logic. No logic at all. With his advanced age and his complicated history, I wonder if the Olympic Committee accepted his application. I close the notebook. After I published my comprehensive cultural guide to Beijing, well ahead of the Olympics, I only wanted to write stories about contemporary China's golden age of ascendancy. I didn't want to discuss past events anymore. I didn't even want to look at the historical materials on the KMT-CCP civil war, land reform, the campaign to suppress counter-revolutionaries, the three anti and the five anti campaigns, the anti-rightist movement, the Great Leap Forward that caused 30 million people to starve to death, the four cleanups or socialist education campaign, the Cultural Revolution, the 1983 anti-spiritual pollution campaign, the Tiananmen massacre, the campaign to suppress the Falun Gong, and so on and so on. I just wanted to forget all those things. If I could rid my mind of it, a new subject would come to me. My own interests had completely changed, and I didn't believe that the new generation of Chinese readers wanted to read about all the wounds and scars of the past 60 years. I really only wanted to write about new people and new things, to write about the Chinese people's golden age of ascendancy. I didn't want to answer Fang Chaodi's email just yet. Maybe later. Chapter 3. From Spring to Summer. A French Crystal Chandelier. Little Xi didn't return my email, so my happy life could continue. I went to the 798 Art District to participate in the opening ceremony for an exhibition of paper-cutting installation art by women from the Northwest. My friend from the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences was the academic co-curator, and she'd invited me to be one of the 10 speakers at the ribbon-cutting ceremony. In my three-minute talk, I summarized the Taiwan New Communities Movement of the 1990s and discussed how Taipei artists and local craftspeople had worked hand-in-hand to bring cultural production in villages back to life. I spoke so well, I got a little emotional myself. The curator also said this exhibition was a fine example of the vitality of Chinese folk culture. That made me feel good all over. A lunch was held at the nearby Golden Qiangnan restaurant, and I was placed at the same table as the representative of the China National Cultural Renaissance Foundation. The foundation had sent only an assistant secretary general. He told me how one of their most important projects was assisting Chinese around the world to locate and retrieve national treasures that had been stolen from the Summer Palace and other sites. Besides that, the foundation was working to revive China's ancient rites throughout the entire nation by, for example, providing financial subsidies to many elementary and middle schools to carry out initiation ceremonies at the beginning of every school year, usually requiring students to bow and pay their respects to their teachers. The foundation was also working hard to have various traditional style rituals declared national statutory ceremonies. After eating a few main dishes, I went to the toilet, and by the time I returned, a big group of people had crowded around my table to listen to the foundation's representative, so I decided to move to another table. My Chinese Academy of Social Sciences friend, Hu Yang, was sitting at a table with a French woman from UNESCO and a Thai who was with the One Village, One Craft Association. I thought that if I joined them, I'd have to speak English, and that would be too much like hard work, so I decided against it. I went over to the Northwest delegation table, where there were many empty seats because the reporters were all over the Renaissance Foundation representative's table interviewing him. Only three elderly ladies who were paper-cutting artists, two female elected village heads, and a Bureau of Culture deputy chief from a prefecture-level city were still at the table. The Northwestern women all looked very honest and kind-hearted. My academy friend always let me see the good side of China. Even though, rationally, I realised that this was not the whole story, emotionally, I still like to meet such good people. The person I really wanted to chat with was the village head, who was only just 20 years old. She was sitting rather far away from me, and I realised I could not understand her rural Mandarin anyway. All I could do was talk to the deputy chief. She had a very loud voice, and her syntax was quite clear. She came from a place called Dingxi in Gansu province. It was originally one of the poorest places in China, but with a few years' hard work after reforms and openness, it finally lifted itself out of poverty. She told me how a few years earlier, the government had convinced the peasants to organise specialist cooperatives and implement dedicated planting schemes, pushing Dingxi to develop into a major potato-producing area. All the Kentucky Fried Chicken and McDonald's outlets in the country used Dingxi potatoes exclusively. She also told me how the local leadership, at a time of rail transport difficulties, used their connections to provide a special train to get the local products to market on time. and also how they organised surplus labour to go to Xinjiang to pick cotton during the cotton harvest season. I learnt a lot from her, and so I asked her very seriously if she could summarise for me why Dingxi was so well governed, while so many places with better local conditions were still unable to rise above the poverty level. Dingxi is very fortunate. We have leaders who know how to work hard and get things done. I could sense that what she said was very practical and very simple. It's all about people, she implied. If the government officials are willing to work hard to make things happen, the common people can make the rural economy hum. That is to say, if the present Communist Party cadre had a slightly higher standard of morality and were willing to work harder on practical projects, the Chinese people would be able to live well. As lunch broke up, I thanked her and she said she hoped that members of the Beijing cultural and academic worlds would come to little Dingxi and give them some guidance. I hypocritically told her that I would certainly find time to visit Dingxi. Feeling very happy after lunch, I went back to the 798 Art District to browse around. Today's 798 Art District is not like the 798 Art District of 10 years ago. Now it apes fashionable foreign trends and tries to combine the bohemian and the bourgeois. That's why it's been criticised for becoming increasingly gentrified, commercialised and kitschy. No matter how you looked at it, though, having a 798 art district is still better than not having one. You can't find another art district on this scale anywhere else in the world. When the foreigners see it, they are all amazed, and their impression of China suddenly changes from China as a backward country to China as the most creative country in the world. In the last 2 years, art and design have become so hot that all the important international art galleries have come to China to set up shop. Famous schools, such as New York's Parsons New School of Design, London's St. Martin's College of Art and Design, and Antwerp's Royal Academy of Fine Arts, had also established campuses close to the 798 Art District. Every time I came to 798, I always took a look at what was on at the Dragon Gate Gallery. This gallery had an extensive collection of French Impressionist and Post-Impressionist oil paintings, including some small works by famous masters and, more importantly, many works by lesser-known figures of that period. Their collection is really worth looking at, and it suits my increasingly conservative tastes. China now matches Japan as a major collecting country for these French Impressionist and Post-Impressionist oil paintings, because there is a group of rich collectors who are fascinated by French painting of that age. The Dragon Gate Gallery had real elegance. The chandelier hanging in the major salon was not made from Chinese materials. It was a genuine baccarat crystal chandelier. As I was looking at that chandelier and ruminating on how the style and temperament of Impressionist and Post-Impressionist oil painting were not quite in sync with baccarat crystal, a man and a woman came towards me, not exactly holding hands, but shoulder to shoulder, and talking and laughing. I tried unsuccessfully to avoid them. The man was Jiang Ling, my movie night friend. When he noticed me, he quickly said, "Oh, Chen, let me introduce you to Professor Wen." "It's been a long time, Wen Lang," I said as we shook hands. "Yes, a very long time, Master Chen," said Wen Lang. Wen Lang actually called me Master Chen too, I noted. "You two know each other," said Jiang Ling, surprised again that I would know someone he never imagined I would. "Master Chen is famous in Hong Kong cultural circles," said Wen Lan. Wen Lan had probably forgotten that I'm Taiwanese. She was dressed expensively, but not vulgarly, rather elegantly glittering. "Can I swap cards with you?" asked Wen Lan. "I forgot to bring any," I lied.
"I have his phone number," offered Jiang Lin.
Wen Lan didn't give me her card.
"Oh, Chen, this is a very nice gallery," said Jiang Lin. "But Professor Wen thinks the prices are even higher than in Paris. There's a painting of a winery that I actually feel I've been to."
"The prices are unreasonably high," Wen Lan said with an air of authority. "Let me see," I said, and abruptly walked away. I was a little depressed, and
no longer felt like looking at paintings, but I suddenly thought of three words to describe Wenlan's elegant manner. Baccarat crystal chandelier.
Let me explain. There was a time when I was getting ready to marry Wenlan. I'd already bought an apartment in Hong Kong for us. Then I learned that she was going to marry someone else. In the autumn of 1991, I went to the mainland to interview an old academic couple who were living under house arrest after the events of 1989. A number of their students from Beijing Normal University had come to visit them. I was quite moved. These young people were not so selfishly concerned with their own futures as to avoid visiting their professors in their time of trouble. The most striking one among them was Wenlan, a senior year student, pretty, easygoing and cultured. She made me feel romantic. She asked all the students to note down their phone numbers for me, and I knew she did it just so that I would be able to contact her. I invited her out and we took a walk around Ho Hai Lake. Her mother was Shanghainese and her father a Beijinger. He edited a journal on theory and worked in the Central Propaganda Department in Sha Tan. Wenlan loved Western literature, was concerned with national affairs and was extremely beautiful. To me, she was perfect. "What is the meaning of existence?" she once asked me. I flailed around, trying to think of something profound. Then I remember she quoted Jean-Paul Sartre. "We must take responsibility for our own lives." I was in love. I went back to Hong Kong for a few days and then contrived a reason to return to Beijing. She said she wanted to go abroad, and I screwed up my courage to ask her to marry me. She laughed and cried, and I thought she had agreed. I told her that we would have no problem living on my salary. I had permanent resident status in Hong Kong, and she could apply to get it as well. She asked me how long after we were married would she become a permanent resident, and I told her if I got help from friends, probably about 2 years. During that time, she could have a multiple entry pass to live in Hong Kong for short periods, and I could go to Beijing frequently on assignment. We would be together quite often, and besides, I said, meeting after a short separation is like a second honeymoon. She seemed excited and full of expectation. We said we'd get married the following summer so she could finish her studies first. I asked her if I should meet her parents, and she said she'd arrange it for my next visit. I thought I was the luckiest guy getting married to such a gorgeous Beijing woman, and she was 18 years younger than me. After I returned to Hong Kong, I happened to see an advertisement for property in Taikoo Sing, so I quickly placed a down payment on the apartment I've mentioned before and started to build a nest for two. After completing the paperwork on the flat, I made a long-distance call to Beijing. Wenlan's father answered and told me she'd gone to Germany. "When will she be back?" I asked, and he abruptly replied, "After she gets married. Don't call her anymore." I hurried to Beijing and phoned her classmates who'd been at the professor's when I'd first met Wenlan. They said they were not really close friends and hadn't kept in touch since that night. I remembered that Wenlan had said her major was in French, but she was also studying German at the Goethe Institute. I rushed over there to look up her records. I found out she'd withdrawn from her studies. A secretary who knew her told me she was going to marry a part-time German teacher who worked at the institute. She wouldn't tell me his name. I pushed my way into the dean's office. The dean was a well-known China expert with a Chinese wife, so he probably had some understanding of the wiles of Chinese women. He listened very patiently to my story and said he could not give me Wenlan's German contact information, but he promised that if I wrote her a letter, he would forward it to her. I went into an empty classroom and sat there, staring blankly for a long time. I picked up my pen several times, wanting to write her a few words, but I just couldn't think how to start. 3 months later, I received a letter from Wenlan. She told me she was married to a German who had been her German teacher, an executive in a German firm in Beijing, and it had been love at first sight. The two of them were living in Germany, and they were very happy together. She didn't say which city they lived in, and she didn't apologize. It was as if nothing had ever happened between us.
She only explained herself in one sentence, the theme of which was that she was like a sparrow that wanted to fly away on the wind and was impatiently longing to spread its wings today because tomorrow would be too late. Before 1992, a mainland bride married to a man in Hong Kong had to wait 2 years before she was granted permanent residence in Hong Kong. After 1992, she would have had to wait 5 years. This inhuman discrimination policy was a violation of basic human rights and a disgrace to Hong Kong. If Willen had married me, she would definitely have had to wait 2 years to live in Hong Kong, so I didn't blame her for choosing to marry a German. I even understood why she had chosen to ride a donkey while searching for a horse. What I was genuinely indignant about was that she so thoroughly misled me and hadn't even bothered to tell me anything about her change of heart. I realized that she was a woman who cared only about her own personal advancement and had no concern for other people. Now I couldn't even be bothered wasting any energy speculating about what kind of relationship she had with Jian Ling. That night, I ate alone at the nearby Singapore restaurant and read an e-book on my cell phone. I use a K-Touch cell phone. K-Touch used to be the king of counterfeit, but now it's a famous international brand. The phone has every function you could want. The interface uses something similar to Sony technology, and the functions combine all the best elements of Apple's iPhone and Amazon's Kindle. Although I still browse in the Sanlian bookstore on a regular basis, ever since I bought my K-Touch e-book digital phone, almost all my books are downloaded from the net. I've already stored the complete works of Jing Yong, Jiang Ailing, and Liu Sheng on my phone. I was trying to understand Liu Sheng's essay, A Lost Good Hell, when I received a call from Wen Lan asking me to come out and meet her. I said I didn't have time, but she insisted, asking me to lunch the next day at the Maison Boulou in Tiananmen Street. It's not easy to catch a taxi near there, and I don't have a driver, and besides, I didn't feel like accommodating that baccarat crystal chandelier. I changed it to a small coffee house in Qiang Liang Lane. "Where is Qiang Liang Lane?" she asked. "It's off Dongxi North Avenue, close to your Sha Tan house. You must know it, right?" I said in exasperation. She deigned to accept my arrangement, so I knew she must want something from me. When we met the next day, just as I expected, she said, "Jian Ling and I are just good friends, so don't go blabbing around about us. He's got a wife, you know." So she wanted to shut me up. She hadn't seen me for 20 years, and this is all she wanted to see me about. But I wasn't really angry. I just wanted to see what other tricks she had up her sleeve. "Jian Ling is a big real estate magnate," I said to tease her. "What's a real estate magnate?" she replied. "Just somebody with a lot of money. Nothing so great about that." What an imperious tone. Was she riding a donkey while searching for a horse again? I have to admit that although Wen Lan is over 40, she looks great for her age and has all the charm of a continental European woman. I can imagine that quite a few men have been captivated by her. "Are you still living in Germany?" She gave me a puzzled look. "I haven't been in Germany for a long time." "Didn't they tell me you married a German and went to Germany?" I alluded to what had happened 20 years earlier. "You mean Hans?" She seemed to be scolding me for not being au courant with her activities. "We haven't been together for ages. Germany was a stifling place, bored me to death. I went to Paris. My ex-husband's Jean-Pierre Louis." Seeing that I didn't react, she added, "A very famous sinologist." I was definitely not familiar with any French sinologists. "Sinologists are all insane. I can't stand them," she remarked. "Jian Ling called you Professor Wen," I said. "Professor Wen or Dr. Wen are both fine. I received my doctorate from Sciences Po in Paris. I'm a specialist in Euro-African affairs and an advisor to the European Union and the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs." I remembered that her father was in the Central Propaganda Department. The apple didn't fall far from the tree.
either inside or outside the organisation, and profiting from both. So then you intend to come back home, I asked.
You mean return to China? She said with an arrogant air.
We'll see. There are people in Europe who are waiting for me now. There's an old aristocrat who keeps asking me to marry him. But now everybody knows that the 21st century belongs to China. If a particularly good opportunity came along, I might consider coming back to do something for China. For the time being, I'll just keep going back and forth. I have a house in Paris and another one in Brussels, and I'm just now looking for a suitable place to buy in Beijing. What about you? What are you doing in Beijing?
I just sit around at home and once in a while I write something.
At that, her interest began to wane. Then she asked, where do you live?
Happiness Village number 2.
Where?
Happiness Village number 2 in Dongji Manhui.
She didn't react. It was probably not posh enough for her. Having sized me up completely, her last remaining interest in me evaporated.
Well, old Chen, I have to go.
Go ahead.
About Jiang Lin.
I made a gesture of zipping up my lips. You're an old Beijinger now, she said in a slightly coquettish manner. When I return to Beijing, you'll have to take me out. I almost said, what on earth for? But I held myself in check. She stood up and added, I expect you to take care of me. In socialist realist fiction, this is known as finishing with a bright tail. It could also be called buying travel insurance. On the one hand, acting like a big, important woman, and on the other hand, acting like a helpless little girl, and all the time, taking and taking. It's amazing that it didn't embarrass her to say such things. I felt like I'd already become her B-list male escort. I watched through the window as a driver opened the door for her and she got into a black BMW. It had an armed police WJ license plate. She's no longer Chinese counterfeit goods, I thought. Now she's a genuine French Baccarat crystal chandelier. But it doesn't matter whether she's a made-in-China kerosene lamp or a French crystal chandelier, she's still on the market, always on the make, and she still has her price. Crack Audio.